This is a recording of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's short story, The Curse of Eve. Robert Johnson was an essentially commonplace man, with no feature to distinguish him from a million others. He was pale of face, ordinary in looks, neutral in opinions, 30 years of age, and a married man. By trade, he was a gentleman's outfitter in the New North Road, and the competition of business squeezed out of him the little character that was left. In his hope of conciliating customers, he had become cringing and pliable, until working even in the same routine from day to day, he seemed to have sunk into a soulless machine rather than a man. No great question had ever stirred in him. At the end of this snug century, self-contained in his own narrow circle, it seemed impossible that any of the mighty, primitive passions of mankind could ever reach him. Yet birth, and lust, and illness, and death are changeless things, and when one of these harsh facts springs out upon a man at some sudden turn of the path of life, it dashes off for the moment his mask of civilization and gives a glimpse of the stranger and stronger face below. Johnson's wife was a quiet little woman, with brown hair and gentle ways. His affection for her was the one positive trait in his character. Together they would lay out the shop window every Monday morning, the spotless shirts in the green cardboard boxes below, the neckties above hung in rows over the brass rails, the cheap studs glistening from the white cards at either side, while the background were the rows of cloth caps and the bank of boxes in which the more valuable hats were screened from the sunlight. She kept the books and sent out the bills. No one but she knew the joys and sorrows which crept into his small life. She had shared his exultations when the gentleman who was going to India had bought 10 dozen shirts and an incredible number of collars, and she had been as stricken as he when, after the goods had gone, the bill was returned from the hotel address with the intimation that no such person had lodged there. For 5 years they had worked, building up the business, thrown together all the more closely because their marriage had been a childless one. Now, however, there were signs that a change was at hand, and that speedily. She was unable to come downstairs, and her mother, Mrs. Peyton, came over from Camberwell to nurse her and to welcome her grandchild. Little qualms of anxiety came over Johnson as his wife's time approached. However, after all, it was a natural process. Other men's wives went through it unharmed, and why should not his? He was himself one of a family of 14, and yet his mother was alive and hearty. It was quite the exception for anything to go wrong. And yet, in spite of his reasonings, the remembrance of his wife's condition was always like a somber background to all his other thoughts. Dr. Miles of Bridgeport Place, the best man in the neighborhood, was retained 5 months in advance, and as time stole on, many little packets of absurdly small white garments with frillwork and ribbon began to arrive among the big consignments of male necessities. And then one evening, as Johnson was ticketing the scarves in the shop, he heard a bustle upstairs, and Mrs. Peyton came running down to say that Lucy was bad, and that she thought the doctor ought to be there without delay. It was not in Robert Johnson's nature to hurry. He was prim and staid and liked to do things in an orderly fashion. It was a quarter of a mile from the corner of the New North Road where his shop stood to the doctor's house in Bridgeport Place. There were no cabs in sight, so he set off upon foot, leaving the lad to mind the shop. At Bridgeport Place, he was told that the doctor had just gone to Harman Street to attend a man in a fit. Johnson started off for Harman Street, losing a little of his primness as he became more anxious. 2 full cabs, but no empty ones, passed him on the way. At Harman Street he learned that the doctor had gone on to a case of measles. Fortunately, he had left the address, 69 Dunstan Road, at the other side of the Regent's Canal. Johnson's primness had vanished now as he thought of the women waiting at home, and he began to run as hard as he could to the Kingsland Road. Some way along, he sprang into a cab, which stood by the curb, and drove to Dunstan Road. The doctor had just left, and Robert Johnson felt inclined to sit down upon the steps and despair. Fortunately, he had not sent the cab away, and he was soon back at Bridgeport Place. Dr. Miles had not returned yet, but they were expecting him every instant. Johnson waited, drumming his fingers on his knees, in a high, dim-lit room, the air of which was charged with a faintly, sickly smell of ether. The furniture was massive, and the books in the shelves were somber, and a squat black clock ticked mournfully on the mantelpiece. It told him that it was 7:30, and that he had been gone 1 hour and 1/4. Whatever would the woman think of him? Every time that a distant door slammed, he sprang up from his chair in a quiver of eagerness. His ears strained to catch the deep notes of the doctor's voice, and then, suddenly, with a gush of joy, he heard a quick step outside and the sharp click of the key in the lock. In an instant, he was out in the hall before the doctor's foot was over the threshold. "If you please, doctor, I've come for you," he cried. "The wife has taken bad at 6 o'clock." He hardly knew what he expected the doctor to do. Something very energetic, certainly, to seize some drugs, perhaps, and rush excitedly with him through the gaslit streets. Instead of that, Dr. Miles threw his umbrella into the rack, jerked off his hat with a somewhat peevish gesture, and pushed Johnson back into the room. "Let's see, did you engage me? You did engage me, didn't you?" he asked in no very cordial voice. "Oh yes, doctor, last November. Johnson, the outfitter, you know, in the new North Road." "Yes, yes, it's a bit overdue," said the doctor, glancing at a list of names in a notebook with a very shiny cover. "Well, how is she?" "Allie, of course, it's your first. You'll know more about it next time. Mrs. Peyton said it was time you were there, sir." "My dear sir, there can be no very pressing hurry in a first case. We shall have an all-night affair, I fancy. You can't get an engine to go without coals. Mr. Johnson and I have had nothing but a light lunch." "We could have something cooked for you, something hot, and a cup of tea." "Thank you, but I fancy my dinner is actually on the table. I can do no good in the earlier stages. Go home and say that I am coming, and I will be round immediately afterwards." A sort of horror filled Robert Johnson as he gazed at this man who could think about his dinner at such a moment. So appallingly important to him was the merest everyday matter of business to the medical man who could not have lived for a year had he not, amid the rush of work, remembered what was due to his own health. To Johnson, he seemed little better than a monster. His thoughts were bitter as he sped back to his shop. "You've taken your time," said his mother-in-law reproachfully, looking down the stairs as he entered. "I couldn't help it," he gasped. "Is it over?" "Over? She's got to be worse, poor dear, before she can be better. Where's Dr. Miles?" "He's coming after he's had dinner." The old woman was about to make some reply when, from the half-opened door behind, a high, whinnying voice cried out for her. She ran back and closed the door, while Johnson, sick at heart, turned into the shop. There he sent the lad home and busied himself frantically in putting up shutters and turning out boxes. When all was closed and finished, he seated himself in the parlor behind the shop. But he could not sit still. He rose incessantly to walk a few paces and then back into a chair once more. Suddenly, the clatter of china fell upon his ear, and he saw the maid pass the door with a cup on a tray and a smoking teapot. "Who's that for, Jane?" he asked. "For the mistress, Mr. Johnson. She says she would fancy it." There was immeasurable consolation to him in that homely cup of tea. It wasn't so very bad, after all, if his wife could think of such things. So light-hearted was he that he asked for a cup also. He had just finished it when the doctor arrived, with a small black leather bag in his hand. "Well, how is she?" he asked genially. "Oh, she's very much better," said Johnson, with enthusiasm. "Dear me, that's bad," said the doctor. "Perhaps it will do if I look in on my morning round." "No, no," cried Johnson, clutching at his thick frieze overcoat. "We are so glad that you have come. And, doctor, please come down soon and let me know what you think about it." The doctor passed upstairs in firm, heavy steps, resounding through the house. Johnson could hear his boots creaking as he walked about the floor above him, and the sound was a consolation to him. It was crisp and decided, the tread of a man who had plenty of self-confidence. Presently, still straining his ears to catch what was going on, he heard the scraping of a chair as it was drawn along the floor. And a moment later, he heard the door fly open, and someone came rushing downstairs. Johnson sprang up with his hair bristling, thinking that something was dreadful, thinking that some dreadful thing had occurred. But it was only his mother-in-law, incoherent with excitement and searching for scissors and some tape. She vanished again, and Jane passed up the stairs with a pile of newly aired linen. Then, after an interval of silence, Johnson heard the heavy, creaking tread of the doctor came down into the parlor. "That's better," said he, pausing with his hand upon the door. "You look pale, Mr. Johnson." "Oh, no, sir, not at all," he answered deprecatingly, mopping his brow with his handkerchief. "There's no immediate cause for alarm," said Dr. Miles. "The case is not all we could wish it. Still, we will hope for the best." "Is there danger, sir?" gasped Johnson. "Well, there is always danger, of course. It is not altogether a favorable case, but it still might be much worse. I have given her a draught. I saw as I passed that they have been doing a little building opposite to you. Is that an improving quarter? The rents go higher and higher. You have a lease of your own little place, eh?" "Yes, sir, yes," cried Johnson, whose ears were straining for every sound from above, and who felt, nonetheless, that it was very soothing that the doctor would be able to chat so easily at such a time. "That's to say, no, sir, I am a yearly tenant." "Ah, I should get a lease if I were you. There's Marshall, the watchmaker, down the street. I attended his wife twice, and saw him through the typhoid when they took up the drains in Prince Street. I assure you his landlord sprung his rent nearly 40 a year, and he had to pay clear out. And he had to pay or clear out." "Did his wife get through it, doctor?" "Oh, yes, she did very well." "Hello, hello!" He slanted his ear to the ceiling with a questioning face, and then darted swiftly from the room. It was March, and the evenings were chill, so Jane had lit the fire, but the wind drove the smoke downwards, and the air was full of its acrid taint. Johnson felt chilled to the bone, though rather by his apprehensions than by the weather. He crouched over the fire with his thin white hands held out of the blaze. At 10 o'clock, Jane brought in the cold joint of meat and laid his place for supper, but he could not bring himself to touch it. He drank a glass of the beer, however, and felt the better for it. The tension of his nerves seemed to have reached upon his hearing, and he was able to follow the most trivial things in the room above. Once, when the beer was still heartening him, he nerved himself to creep on tiptoe up the stairs and to listen to what was going on. The bedroom door was half an inch open, and through the slit he could catch a glimpse of the clean-shaven face of the doctor, looking wearier and more anxious than before. Then he rushed downstairs like a lunatic, and running to the door he tried to distract his thoughts by watching what was going on in the street. The shops were all shut, and some rollicking boon companions came shouting along from the public house. He stayed at the door until the strangers had thinned, and then came back to his seat by the fire. In his dim brain, he was asking himself questions which had never intruded themselves before. Where was the justice of it? What had his sweet, innocent little wife done that she should be used so? Why was nature so cruel? He was frightened at his own thoughts, and yet wondered that they had never occurred to him before. As the early morning drew in, Johnson, sick at heart and shivering in every limb, sat with his great coat huddled round him, staring at the gray ashes and waiting hopelessly for some relief. His face was white and clammy, and his nerves had been numbed into the half-conscious state by the long monotony of misery. But suddenly all his feelings leapt into keen life again as he heard the bedroom door open and the doctor's steps upon the air. Robert Johnson was precise and unemotional in everyday life, but he almost shrieked now as he rushed forward to know if it were over. Yeah. One glance at the stern, drawn face which met him showed that it was no pleasant news which had sent the doctor downstairs. His appearance had altered as much as Johnson's during the last few hours. His hair was on end, his face flushed, his forehead dotted with beads of perspiration. There was a peculiar fierceness to his eyes, and about the lines of his mouth, a fighting look as befitted a man who for hours on end had been striving with the hungriest of foes for the most precious of prizes. But there was a sadness, too, as though his grim opponent had been overmastering him. He sat down and leaned his head upon his hand like a man who is fagged out. "I thought it my duty to see you, Mr. Johnson, and to tell you that it is a very nasty case. Your wife's heart is not strong, and she has some symptoms which I do not like. What I wanted to say is that if you would like to have a second opinion, I shall be very glad to meet with anyone whom you might suggest." Johnson was so dazed by his want of sleep and the evil news that he could hardly grasp the doctor's meaning. The other, seeing him hesitate, thought that he was considering the expense. "Smith or Hawley would come for 2 guineas, said he, "but I think Pritchard of the City Road is the best man." "Oh yes, bring the best man," cried Johnson. "Pritchard would want 3 guineas. He is a senior man, you see. I'd give him all I have if he would pull her through. Shall I run for him?" "Yes. Go to my house first and ask for a green baize bag. The assistant will give it to you. Tell him I want the ACE mixture. Her heart is too weak for chloroform. Then go for Pritchard and bring him back with you."